All right. Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to my last session of Tech Days this year on hidden .NET framework gems. I assume that some of you have had a chance to actually scan the QR code like my last session about C# language internals. And so let's take a look at what people want to see. So let's navigate to this thing over here. How do I find my results? That's going to be the most challenging part of this whole thing. There we go. And the winner is formattable strings by far. Conditional weak tables next. Object pooling in Roslyn is popular. Regex compilation as well. Expression trees. So we'll just, you know, get started with these and see how far we get. And just work in a descending order. Okay. So formattable strings and string interpolation in C# 6.0, what's so interesting about that stuff? Well, let's just go and, you know, get started and take a closer look at that. How many of you have actually used string interpolation in C# 6 already? Okay, yeah. How many think it's just a replacement for string.format? Okay, yeah. It kind of is, but I wouldn't be asking that question if it were. So it's not completely a replacement for just string.format. In fact, it has a little bit more capabilities to it. And so let me just go and get started here. Let me just call this thing demo tag days. Here we go. And we'll just take a look at string interpolation, take a look behind the scenes. This is, again, one of those talks where we want to sort of take a look how things work, as opposed to just, you know, have the marketing talk about, isn't this fancy and wouldn't you give us all your money? So we'll just, you know, take a closer look here. So everyone knows what string interpolation kind of looks like. You know, you can have var s equals $, and then you can say hello, comma, you got, you know, args.length, args. Okay? It's a very simple thing to do. You put curly braces, and obviously what you have within the curly braces is any kind of expression. So like if you want to, you know, do environment.exit in here, well, I think that returns void, but you know, whatever. Anything that has a value, you can put inside of those curly braces, as long as it fits in an expression, okay? Now, in this particular case, you're totally right. Like, this thing will actually translate to a string.format call. And of course, like, why did we invent this? The reason being that, in fact, I have been working on systems where you actually end up shipping something in production, especially in exception handling code paths, you know, where you want to log something to a log, and you do this kind of thing, right? Args, comma, length, comma, 42. The thing is not in balance, right? You know, you're going to log the exception with some info, and you have like 17 format holes that you want to put in the string, and you supply 16 parameters or 18 parameters. And then the exception happens, and your only hope to sort of know what happened has been sort of thrown out of the window because the string.format says, like, invalid format string. Right? You don't want to have that happen. And of course, with the first thing, you will never have that because we do the counting for you. And compilers tend to be pretty good to count high numbers, right? Like, so, you know, we will not lose count, and this will literally translate to string.format. In fact, I'm going to prove that to you by just going to ILDASM and take a look at, like, how this thing works. Here's ILDASM, or ILSpy in this case. There's a new version available. One tip, you know, if you want to study how the language works, never upgrade ILSpy, you know. Then you will see, like, you know, more dirty secrets than, you know, when they try to do fancy decompilation. So in this case, you know, I think I can go down here and actually see, indeed, yeah, it has become a string.format call, okay? So that's all good, you know. That's what you would have been able to write yourself. Now, there's, of course, a couple of things to point out. Because it's still a string.format call, you have all the typical performance caveats that come with that. A string.format, well, you have to put yourself in the shoes of string.format. What does it have to do? It has to take that string, lex it, and parse it to find all those holes with those zeros, ones, twos, and whatever, and sort of make sense of what you want to do. And that's one thing it has to do every single time you're going to execute this code. It's pretty efficient at doing that, no biggie typically. But still, it has to do all of that logic at runtime. And then secondly, string.format, as you can see over here, has a couple of overloads, like you have one that takes in an object arg, so you already get implicit boxing here because you're passing an int as an object, so you get some boxing. But then if you sort of go down here and you actually have a lot of those things, you see you have an overload with 2 and with 3, and then we give up and we say we can't go to 25 here, so we'll just have a params object array. So if you have string.format with a lot of formatters, you will also incur an allocation of an object array. Okay? So that's string.format in a nutshell. And of course, people will say, well, it's a great feature, but you know, I would like to be able to localize my things and what have you, or I would like to print this thing using the invariant culture, as you typically do in producing log messages and stuff that are only to be meant to be read, you know, in a culture insensitive way. So you want to have a way of doing culture insensitive stuff here. Does anyone know how to do that with format strings on an interpolation? What? Point to string. Well, this is something you can do over here, yeah. You can do a toString and pass in a format provider. That's one thing you could be doing here, but that's still happening on system.string. At that point, it's too late. Like, we've already stuffed all the stuff into the string, we get the string, and then you're going to format the string again, you know? Like, so that's not really going to help here. But we have this whole interesting string, formattable, ugh. Yep. How the fuck did we call this thing again? Help! Like, yeah. What? Yeah, I think it is actually. No. Help! Somebody look it up online. You know, like, am I not having the right flavor of the framework? Likely I have an old 4.2. My God, we're so old, you know. Yeah, formattable string. There we go. Like, you know, yeah. When in doubt, check your framework version. Okay, like, this was totally scripted. No, it wasn't. Okay. But so you have formattable string.invariant. Okay, and take a look at this thing. It doesn't take in a string, it takes in a formattable string. And so when you pass this thing to it, right, here you go. Didn't you tell me that this thing is string.format and it returns a string? That parameter. Well, that parameter is now being assigned to what? It's being assigned to this thing called a formattable string. And so interpolated string literals in C# 6 can be assigned to a couple of different types. They can be assigned to an iFormattable, a formattable string, and a system.string. You're totally right. If you assign it to system.string, you get string.format. But if you assign it to a formattable string, well, what you get is a formattable string. And what's a formattable string look like? Well, you can already kind of see it over here. It will receive the format, it will also receive the number of arguments, and it will have some way of retrieving all those arguments, all those holes that you're filling in with your expressions. Okay? So formattable string is this thing that then allows a method like invariant to actually do string.format using the format in the property, all the arguments that we have, and pass down to that thing the culture info. So you can also create your own extension methods here, or your own static method somewhere that actually have not invariant, but you know, Dutch Netherlands and you know, French Belgium and whatever you pick, right? So that's what this invariant method does. Now, of course, it's interesting to see how this thing compiles. So let's go back to ILDASM or ILSpy. Let me hit F5, refresh on this whole thing. Oops, here we go. And let's take a look at what happens now. That's my previous demo. Let's get rid of that. Here we go. Main, it becomes formattable string.invariant of formattable string factory. That was the thing I was looking for in system runtime compiler services. That does formattable string.create. And then instead of passing the compiler synthesized string with all the placeholders to string.format, we pass it into this factory. And then we pass at the bottom here new object array containing all the arguments. So what's interesting about that? Well, actually, there is a to-do that will be taken at some point into the .NET framework to actually create overloads for the create method that actually have, again, that whole triangle of different overloads that we can bind to, one with one object, two objects, three objects, four, and then give up to a params array. However, in the first release that we shipped of formatted strings, it actually always takes in a params array. So if you're ever analyzing some heap and you're seeing like, oh my god, there's a lot of those object arrays sort of being allocated and they just contain a single element, you know, it could be because you have formatted strings that you're not just passing, you know, to string.format implicitly, but that you're actually converting to a formattable string to pass it, for example, to invariant. So the meta lesson here is actually, when you're designing an API, always have your work items ready to sort of have overloads, because params array is kind of the bottom out case, right? Where you say, you know, if the user has that many arguments, just stuff it all in an array. But arrays are heap allocated, so they cost something. So if you're really performance critical, you may want to do the same thing as string.format, as console.writeline, a whole bunch of APIs that sort of provide a bunch of little overloads. And of course, don't go overboard. Like, don't go to 8,192 overloads. I'm not even sure whether we can actually handle that many arguments at the runtime level. I need to check that. But, you know, use moderation, OK? So formattable strings or interpolated strings, string.format is one thing, but if you want to impress people at the bar, say, well, this thing can also convert to this mythical type, and you should definitely have .NET 4.6.2 installed, because if you don't have that, you will look shameful on stage. Like that's all of that kind of stuff. So formatted strings, not just a story of replacing string.format, a story of something a little bit more rich than that. And the second lesson, of course, is if you want to use localization, basically just build a method very similar to the invariant method, which, by the way, you can, of course, use using static for that, right? Like this, you know, to sort of just make it possible to write invariant of a string literal as opposed to have to fully qualify that thing with the type name all the time. So you can totally have something like Dutch with that thing and Belgian and whatever, OK? It's not a language, Belgian. OK. Next thing we will take a look at, next to formattable strings, the conditional weak tables. How many know conditional weak tables? OK, well, that's actually definitely worthy of the status of some like little corner thing in the .NET framework that not that many people are aware of. So conditional weak tables are one of my favorite data structures. You know. Where do they sit? They sit in system runtime compiler services, where the majority of types say, this is for .NET framework infrastructure only. Please don't touch or don't consider using it, because we'll break it at some point. Conditional weak table is one of the exceptions to that rule. By the way, what sits here is things like all the machinery between async state machines, for example, for async methods. Other things that sit here are call sites for when you're using dynamic typing and the DLR, the dynamic language runtime. Call site support sits in the same namespace. But we also have this cool thing here called conditional weak table. And let me actually just start by using string here for a moment. And let me just F12 to that thing. Here we go. Conditional weak table. This conditional weak table, it definitely should be something interesting. How can I tell it's interesting? Not by looking at this thing. You already see something. Enables compilers to dynamically attach object fields to managed objects. OK, can use it for that. And I'll show you in just a second what that means. But over here, you see it definitely does something a little bit low level, because it has a finalizer. OK, like so it's always good to search for objects that have finalizers, because you will end up with some interesting stuff to look at. OK, now don't put them on your own type so that other people look at your types. Tried that, didn't work. So what does this thing do? Well, it looks a lot like a dictionary. It doesn't implement iDictionary or something, but it has try, get value, it has add, get or create value, and this mysterious get value with a callback. Okay. So what this thing allows you to do is basically say, I have an object, okay, and it has to be a reference type, and I want to associate something with it. So for example, say that you have some request pipeline, and you have some object called request. And maybe you get the request from some other framework component or some library you're using. It's a sealed class. You can't really wrap it with anything. You know, at some point, a request is being created, right? Var request equals new request. And they give it to you. And there you have your request object. And now you want to start, you know, correlating things with that object, right? You know, for the lifetime of that object, you want to sort of associate some state with it. Okay? Now, you can't extend it. You can't derive from that class because it's sealed. And even if you could derive from it, it's not quite clear how you would sort of take an existing request and sort of upgrade it to, like, you know, a base, a subtype that has more stuff on it. So with the conditional weak table, what you can build is the following. You can say, I want to have a conditional weak table that maps a request onto, and then you can use whatever you like over here. In this case, I will use, let's say, you know, a dictionary, you know, just to come up with something of string to object, a hash table. You know, not the best choice potentially, but whatever. So now I have my conditional weak table. And a conditional weak table is something that you can actually do the following with. You can say CWT, right? And you can say get value. And in get value, you can give it the object, which is the key, in this case the request, and then you get a callback. Okay? Now what does that callback look like? It's very similar to add or get kind of methods, you know, that you have on concurrent data structures. Now this thing here is a callback that is expected given a request object to return an instance of that thing, okay? An instance of the value. So I'm just going to stuff an empty dictionary in there, but I will do some other things. You know, let me actually put in this whole thing, you know, my request ID or something, and I'll put in here a GUID.NewGUID. Okay, so I've just stuffed something on top of that, and now this looks an awful lot like you know, just a regular dictionary, you know, but you wouldn't want to have a static global dictionary in your application where for every single request object that you get, you want to stuff it into a key slot in a dictionary. And I'll explain why you don't want to do that in just a moment. But now, everywhere you go, everywhere you get that request object through your entire application, assuming that you have access to the conditional weak table, which you may be storing in static or something that you have available in a whole bunch of places, what you can do now is you can say CWT, right, dot get value, or you know, you can use other methods here like try get value to check whether it exists. Given the request, give me, you know, its additional data, right? And I'm not using C#7 yet, so I can't use an out variable declaration, which you've learned about earlier this week. So I'll have to do this kind of monkey business here of declaring a variable. But now, in every single place, you know, where I get that object, I can look in the conditional weak table to say, do you have an entry for that thing? And if so, I want to find all those extended properties that I've associated with that object. So it's as if you have extension fields, right? It's as if you've sort of extended the object with additional stuff on it. And the reason that sits in the compiler services namespace is because some dynamic languages need that capability. You have a fixed object layout at compile time, but you still want dynamic languages to be able to say, I got an object here, the user wants to add a field to it. Like, think of JavaScript, you can just do curly curly, assign it to an object, and then later do, you know, object.a equals 5, .b equals 6, and so on, right? Like the layout can sort of grow at runtime. So with a conditional weak table, you can do that. You can associate something with the object. Now, what's the whole interesting thing about a conditional weak table? It's actually a type that the garbage collector knows about. As soon as your object, your request object, is no longer reachable from any other place, so it's actually eligible to become garbage, the garbage collector can remove the entry in the conditional weak table. And that's not something you would be able to do with a dictionary, where the keys are either your request, because then you're responsible to remove it from that darn data structure at the right time, or if you're more clever but still quite stupid, by creating, you know, a dictionary of weak references to requests, because the weak references will still be sitting in that dictionary, nor can you actually look up things based on a weak reference, of course. Like, you know, so that's a complete dead avenue. So you need some way inside the runtime to be able to associate something with an object and still not hold a strong reference to the object, right? And that's what the conditional weak table does. So at the point that this request object is no longer available, you can actually see that the request you know, is not held alive by the conditional weak table. It's very similar to weak references, but it's for entries into a dictionary-like structure. Where do I use that? Well, currently working on the Bing service, a whole bunch of backend stuff. And in a lot of cases, you have some objects sort of flowing through a request pipeline. And in some cases, I even do control that object. But in certain flavors and certain configurations, I want to associate something with it. Think about the following. if you want to do some timing kind of analysis, sometimes it's easy to just put, you know, a stopwatch on the back of every object that you're creating, right? And then at some other place, you know, you can sort of record timings. You know, that's one thing you could be doing. Every time you touch the object, you go to its clock on its back and see how long it has been, you know, going through all those methods, and you're not passing around a stopwatch and, like, you know, have to change your whole API structure. You can simply put a backpack on the object, and you're allowed to sort of do, you know, a search into the backpack at every single security point that the object is hitting in your API. So that's one thing you can do with a conditional weak table. Very powerful type, totally, you know, hidden in a corner. Use it with care. It has some locking implications inside of it. But take a look at the code. And in fact, let me just show you how you can see that types are interesting. And everything is open source now on GitHub, so you can see how this thing works. But if you go to the conditional weak table over here, you will actually see, well, the font is a little bit too big, honestly, you know, to make sense of anything here. But there's this fancy thing called a dependent handle. And that's a runtime internal data structure that actually the GC knows about. It's a reference to an object that, you know, the GC can sort of go after. And, you know, when that dependent object is no longer valid, this entry in that dictionary can also be taken away. So that's kind of the crux of it. And you will also find a whole bunch of internal calls to the CLR inside this thing, external methods and those kind of things. And what you can also see is that there is a pretty big lock around that thing. So if you use them at some point, also make sure to use them in a wise way, like, you know, not to end up with a global lock in your application, for example. But you can have multiple of these. You can partition, you know, the way you store things into conditional weak tables and have multiple instances, all sorts of tricks you can play. Just be aware that that type exists, and it's pretty cool. Okay? So conditional weak table, put a backpack on an object without extending it, you know, in the static typing. So that's conditional weak tables. Object pooling in Roslyn. That's a very good one as well. We've seen Roslyn this morning. How many were in my talk about writing custom analyzers, right? You remember that I told about Roslyn using immutable data structures all over the place, right? That's one interesting thing. Like, you may sort of say, doesn't that result in a whole bunch of allocations? And luckily for data structures like trees, that's not really the case. Like, if you have a syntax tree, you don't really, you know, need to clone the whole thing if you want to change a single node. You just have to kind of clone, you know, you can reuse all the subtrees that, you know, have been unchanged, and then you can sort of create a new spine all the way to the root of the tree, reusing all the things that haven't changed and just sort of wire up the new thing that you want to stuff in the tree. So that's not too bad. But what's the second thing that an editor like Visual Studio deals with all the time? What's the data structure that you think that this code is stored in? It's a darn string, right? You have a ginormous string, right? Or maybe a lot of medium-sized strings, right? Now, if you're going to use strings and construct strings at runtime an awful lot, you will want to use string builders, of course. You know, string builders that allow you to sort of build strings on the fly, append things, and all that kind of stuff, and not do, you know, silly things like string concatenation, which basically creates a lot of garbage, right? Like, you have a string, you concatenate something to it, the two original strings become garbage, and you have a new string. You don't want to do that, so you want string builders. But then if you do a lot of manipulations on strings, what do you end up with? A whole bunch of garbage, namely a whole bunch of string builder instances that you use to build your strings, right? So wouldn't it be nice that we can reuse those string builders, right? Because what does a string builder do? It dynamically allocates as soon as you add things to it. So it starts off with a default capacity of n number of characters. You add something to it, it will dynamically grow by reallocating an array, creating a bigger array, and they grow. And so as you use a string builder, they get more space, they will have less, you know, pressure on the garbage collector because they already have a pretty big byte array or character array sitting inside of them. And then at the end you will say, thank you, you served me well, I will throw you away. They have grown so that they don't have to grow again in the future. So why can't we just clear the internal array, put that string builder back into some object pool of string builders, and the next time we need to build a string, check one out of our object pool, use that one, no new allocations, no new dynamic array growth, all of that kind of stuff, and we sort of get to a point of doing far less garbage collections. Okay, and that's exactly what we do in Roslyn. Let me actually show you a pretty interesting class that we have. Oh, by the way, in one of my previous talks, I was battling with RLDASM, right? You know, that I couldn't change the font without running as administrator. So I created, like, you know, an issue over here, and I'll submit a pull request later today. You know, I started working on that. So, string builders, right? Yeah, OK. Let me just go to github.com/.NET/Roslyn. Here we go. Take a look at the .NET compiler source code. And I'll search in here. I hope we didn't remove that type recently, because then it will be kind of disappointing. Object pool. OK, where's my object pool? Here we go. Object pool backtick 1. And that's a pretty interesting type that we have here that you can use as a template to build your own object pools if you have to. And what I want to point out about this thing is how easy it is to use, how relatively easy it is to implement, and, you know, how much you can sort of learn by just browsing the .NET framework source code and, you know, everything in Roslyn. So as you can see over here, it's a generic implementation of object pooling pattern, predefined pool size, and you sort of want to have frequently used objects. You want to keep them in the pool so you can reuse them. What can you use this for? A whole bunch of things. Right? You can use them for string builders. You can use them for, say, dictionaries. Right? If you have a dictionary temporarily during your lifetime of your application, you need some dictionary. You want to stuff a whole bunch of things in it. The dictionary is growing. It's allocating buckets. It's having a whole bunch of internal capacity. Right? That's a price you're paying. But you don't want to throw away the whole thing at the end. You can simply do clear on it, which clears all the internal structures in the object, and then, you know, reuse it at a later point in time. So this object pool type actually allows you to sort of build exactly that. And so what does it look like? And that's an interesting thing. First of all, this is another thing. Coincidence or not, you know, I'll leave it to you to decide, you know, whether there's any structure in my talks here, even though you decided what I will talk on. But right after talking about the conditional weak table, we have this conditional weak table thing over here as well. What this thing does, and that's an implementation detail, I'll just talk to you about that very briefly. The value in a conditional weak table, as soon as the key is no longer reachable, the whole entry in the conditional weak table goes away. What's the implication of that? The value becomes garbage. What's the implication of a value becoming garbage? The garbage collector will delete it. What does the garbage collector do if you opt into an object being, you know, garbage collected? You can install a finalizer. So you can actually see when that object on the left-hand side, the T, is no longer held onto by anyone, you know, eventually it will drop out of that table. The finalizer on the value will run, and you will actually run the finalizer there to sort of see somebody lost this T. We use this thing called a leak tracker here. It's something you can build using a conditional weak table, which actually allows us to find when somebody is not using our object pool correctly. They go to the object pool and they say, give me a string builder, and they never return it. They drop it on the floor, it becomes garbage. Then that leak tracker will see, you lost the key, hence the value becomes unreachable. The finalizer of the value runs and will do a debugger search saying, you're using this pool incorrectly. If you run something out of the pool, you have to return it eventually. Like so, you can use this thing in pretty fancy ways. So please take a look at this object pool thing. But how does it work? We have over here just an array of elements, right? That will actually contain the pooled objects, okay? And then at the bottom here, the way you will use this thing is by, you know, using something called allocate. And this allocate thing, there's a whole bunch of interesting things that, you know, you should take a look at. Because your original gut feeling would be to do the following, right? I need to access a pool, which is a storage of objects that I want to cache and keep around. Clearly, I need to put a fat lock around that thing, right? So that, like, when somebody's getting something out of the pool, that no two people get the same instance. Because if two people get the same instance out of the pool, then they will be operating on the same object that you're renting out of the pool. Like two people getting the same string builder instance, both of them adding stuff to it, you get rubbish, obviously. So you could say, well, let's just use something very simple like, you know, a lock around the whole thing. But in fact, you know, you can do more clever things. Like, you know, an interlocked compare exchange for the first item in the pool. Because, you know, in a lot of cases, you know, the first item in the pool will be the one that you want to return. And you just want to make sure nobody else can get it, so you can basically swap it out for null. And if that doesn't work, then you can go down some slower path where you actually do a whole bunch of other things, you know, like, you know, potentially acquiring locks. In fact, we don't acquire a lock at all. We then go to an array to sort of find an element in an array and sort of check one out. And if we don't find an object in the pool, we simply allocate a new one. So instead of doing new string builder in Roslyn, we never do new string builder. We always go to a string builder pool and ask to allocate a string builder out of it. We use the string builder, and then at the end, we will return the string builder to the pool by calling free on it. Now it starts to look a little bit like C and C++ kind of things, right, with explicit lifetime management. So don't do that for every single object, obviously. But you know, if you have one of those hot objects in your code that you use all the time, like string builders because you're having some text engine or something, you know, this could be a very, you know, useful approach. And in fact, this is a generic type or a generic class, so you can actually copy this thing. It has actually been you know, battle tested in Roslyn. In fact, every time you're typing in Visual Studio and we have to use string builders to concatenate the stuff that you're doing and sort of render the string and all of that, it goes through the string builder pool. And you will actually see that as soon as you start working in Visual Studio, you don't see any dynamic growth of the number of string builder instances in the heap. We will always reuse existing ones. Yep. Very, very good question. Very good question. Say that you have a string builder for a very large file, and you have a huge string builder, and you stuff it in the pool. You know, isn't it not sort of, you know, leaking a bunch of memory, right? Like you have this pre-allocated space sitting there. In fact, if you go a little bit further into the Roslyn source code, the subtypes that use this will actually have a policy upon free. They will say, when it gets freed and the string builder has not grown, I believe it's over 1024 characters, I will return it to the pool, otherwise I'll make it garbage. Yeah. So you can layer policies on top of that. Very good question, actually. That's one of the very first things that had to be added to that. Like, you know, so when you just load some ginormous thing, you know, you don't want to sort of keep that thing sitting in there. In fact, again in Bing, I'm using this thing all the time. Like, you know, for a whole bunch of stuff that we're doing, we use pools, you know, to sort of reduce, you know, the churn of allocations and garbage collections that are happening eventually. So object pools, interesting, but also interesting to sort of see how they were built. Like, you know, they also have interesting if-devs in here, where you can sort of see, like this thing is pretty interesting. When somebody's allocating an object, we will do a big slow thing called systemdiagnostics.stacktrace to see where you're allocating it from. And we'll store that together with that object, like, you know, using conditional weak tables and stuff. And then at the point, at the end, you know, if you lose that object and you don't return it to the pool, we can say it was that guy on that call stack that checked out this object and he didn't use it correctly, right? Like, you know, those if-def kind of things where in debug, you know, you sort of do things with all sorts of stuff, right? Like, you know, capturing the current stack trees, the thread that things are happening on, you know, whether it's a Monday or a Tuesday. Like, you know, capture all the information, store it in debug builds, and then, you know, sort of put a finger of blame to the people who don't use it correctly. So that's what's happening over here. Because you can imagine if there's one place in the code where we don't do it correctly, the efficiency of our pool, of course, goes down, and we may not notice. Okay? So that's object pools. Okay? Next, you know, I actually still have time for one or two more, which is actually very good. So conditional weak tables, we saw object pooling. Regex compilation and expression trees are kind of very similar in what they use. So let me actually talk a little bit about that. How many of you have used compiled regular expressions? Good. In fact, oh, actually, I do have a dump of something sitting somewhere. Let me try to find this thing really quick. The other day, I was actually debugging an issue with MS Build. Not the most fun thing to debug, but you know, had to be done. So, ctemp vs dump. Okay. and hopefully we get symbols eventually here. But this was an issue with loading things from .NET Core. I'll boost the font in just a moment here. Actually, I should boost the font first. I seem to be struggling with font things all the time, you know, during this conference, you know. Things forgetting the font size and what have you. But so I have the WinDebug here attached to a dump. It's called vsdump.dmp. So what happened the other day was the following thing. I was just, you know, pulling sources from GitHub for the core CLR and the core .NET framework, and I opened a solution in Visual Studio. And what happened was that Visual Studio was kind of hanging for 5, 10, 15 minutes, and then I gave up on it. I say, like, this is impossible. Like, you know, it's loading the project. And I killed it. I did it again. It was still hanging. And so I decided to create a dump for it and try to take a look at what's actually going on. And what was going on was the following. So how many of you have used SOS? Okay. Not that many noticed. So this is WinDebug, native debugger. Which you may want to use in cases where you really need to go deep into the system and sort of see like what's going on. And you can also use that for .NET code. In fact, that's the wrong SOS. C, Windows, Microsoft .NET, framework V4.0.3.0.3.19, SOS.dll. And it's wrong again. You know, what am I doing wrong? Oh, that's 64-bit. Sorry, I loaded the wrong debugger. I need 32-bit instance of WinDebug. Sorry for that, you know, that's why it doesn't work. Guess, you know, what will happen next is, of course, you know, setting the font dialog again. Story of my life. Exactly. Font dialogs in those low-level tools, you know, are sort of something that an intern, you know, 1 year had to add, and, you know, we thank them for it after the end of the summer vacation, and you know, like that's what it is. So here we go. We have SOS, you know, loaded. SOS stands for Son of Strike. Little quick, you know, anecdote about that whole thing. Son of Strike. What can you be struck by? You can be struck by lightning. Lightning was lightning. Okay, lightning was the code name of the common language runtime, and in fact, if you use ILDASM, oh, you see, I'm working on my pull request to change the font dialog in ILDASM. You know, I was not cheating here. But if you open ILDASM, you still see that ILDASM's icon is a lightning bolt. So again, if you want to go to the bar, you want to impress somebody there, you can totally tell the story about the CLR used to be codenamed Lightning, and there's still traces of it in the tools that you use every day. Okay, so the son of the runtime called Strike was the debugger. So the debugger extension was called the son of Strike. Okay, so that's the name of SOS. It doesn't mean like you're crying out for help, you know, SOS, you know, that kind of thing. So I have this thing loaded here. I'll switch to thread number 0, and I'll actually dump the CLR stack over here. And SOS tends to throw an access violation the first time you use it since some build, then you just do it again and it works. You know, like it's self-healing code. It's beautiful. Also something I should be submitting a pull request for, I guess. So what was happening? What was happening when Visual Studio was hanging? I basically ended up with this thing. I just, you know, wanted to point this out. What I was doing is was actually searching because of some bug in the project.json file. It started actually scanning my whole file system, my whole C drive, for traces of project.json files to pick something up from, doing a recursive file system search. Took a long, long time. And on top of that, we were kind of looking at the names of files using a regex interpreter. And so when you see something hanging and spending a lot of time, and you see in there regex interpreter don't go and scan, and if I would have let this run for a little bit longer and broke into it, the call stack would likely be pretty much the same, but maybe in a different phase of the regular expression interpreter. This is a trace that you're actually executing a regular expression all the time, and you may as well compile it. Now, when you compile a regular expression, the whole implementation of it, which is actually an NFA and a DFA and all of those, you know, finite state machine kind of theory, that whole thing gets dumped into IL code. So you actually get JIT compiled code that actually implements your regular expression, you know, lexer and all of that kind of stuff that goes over your characters and basically checks whether the input matches a certain regular expression. And so that's actually doing compilation of code at runtime. And that's a very, very powerful thing, actually. So regular expressions do that if you use regexoptions.compiled when you create a regular expression. But something else that does that is actually expression trees, which is the next thing that people asked for. So let me just, you know, show you something about that. Okay, it's the same principle of how to see the code that it generates at runtime. So say that you use an expression tree. How many know expression trees? So that's the stuff that Link2SQL, for example, uses to capture the user intent in a link query, and then at runtime translate it to some different language, for example, SQL. But the other thing you can do with it is you can basically build up an expression tree at runtime using factory methods and stuff. And then at the end, you know, once you've manipulated it, so you have an expression tree here, you do a whole bunch of things to construct an expression at runtime, you can do f.compile on it, and what you get back is a func of int, a delegate instance, which contains runtime compiled code that's, you know, of course, what you've specified in the expression tree. And so using that, you can do things like, you know, you're building, say, a JSON deserializer. And every time you deserialize an object, you really need to instantiate an instance of a certain type. You need to set 15 properties, all of that kind of stuff. What you could be doing is you could be using reflection. But reflection is quite slow. So instead, what you will do is you'll use the expression tree API to build a little delegate that actually does all of that stuff for you. A delegate that actually has an implementation to instantiate the person object, set the name and the age property. And that's going to be it. So basically, generate code at runtime. Now, when I do console.readline over here to just be able to attach a debugger, you can see that stuff happening at runtime. And that's what I want to point out here. So let me just run this whole thing here. It's running now. And I'll show you the IL code that this thing has generated. It's going to be quite disappointing IL code because we're simply returning a constant 42. But, you know, we can actually take a look at that. And so, again, what I want to show you is that you can use, let's see whether it saves the font. That's not what I want to show you. We can actually see if it, you know, is easy to actually see that IL code. So I'm going to attach to a process using WinDebug here. It's a, you know, reasonably easy tool to use, you know, if you do just the basic kind of things. I'm just going to attach to my demo project here. We know the answer to my question about font dialogues. It does not remember. Okay, so here we go. And now we're going to load the son of strike in the place where the CLR is installed. So we load this thing. And what I can do with this thing is I can dump heap, you know, all objects in the process of a certain type. So if you ever have a crash dump or something, in fact, Martin, another Belgian who was here this week, was actually giving a talk just an hour or so ago about analysis of issues in the NuGet service. He actually showed, you know, that you can also use those dump files in Visual Studio to take a look at what actually went wrong. Now, if you want to go really deep, you can actually also use WinDebug, and that's what I'm doing here. So what I'm doing is I'm dumping all instances of a certain type on the heap, in this case, something called dynamic method. And in fact, you have two of those guys. And what I can do now is I can take those dynamic objects. I have to sort of like, you know, poke a little bit. And I can do dump IL on them. And there you go. So now you have that dynamic method, which is a runtime generated code that came out of my expression tree. And when I did dot compile on that thing, it generated code here. Again, personal experience in the Bing team, we actually compile queries that people actually submit to the service, for example, through Cortana, we actually compile those as standing queries in a service that are evaluated all the time in an event processing system. And of course, because they will be evaluated a lot whenever there is like information about traffic or news or whatever, we have to evaluate the user filters. We actually use expression trees for that. We basically compile the code at runtime, but we don't know the code up front, because users ask different questions. We can't statically compile all the questions in the world. So we actually do runtime code gen. And then if you do that, you know, it's sometimes interesting to take a look at, like, you know, what the code generated looks like. And you could actually find interesting issues with that. Issues like, you know, here's something you can do in terms of performance. Now, what's interesting about this whole IL generation thing is that in certain cases, you don't want to pay that price. So how many of you have actually used expression tree compilation at runtime? Hope, yeah, a few. Well, we have a new option available actually now in .NET Core. It's actually something I helped ship because in Roslyn, not in Roslyn, in the Bing team, we actually needed this as well. We actually shipped a, I can maybe find it over here. We shipped an expression interpreter. And so now, in where's the pull request that we did for this? Somewhere in here, you know, here, unconditionally enable the expression interpreter. So starting with RC1 of .NET Core, which is a long time ago, we actually have an overload to the compile method, and the compile method now has on top of it, which is not available here yet in the full .NET framework, it has an overload with a Boolean where you can say, I would like the expression tree to be compiled or interpreted. And so now you have this interesting dial. If you have an expression tree like we have in Bing that executes millions and millions of times, we want to spend the time to actually do the compilation, just like the Visual Studio case of doing regex matches on my whole file system. You want those things to be compiled. But in other cases, you may want it to be interpreted. If you simply use it a one-time thing, you know, you don't want to sort of let the runtime generate a whole bunch of IL code and JIT compilation at the runtime. If you know, I want to create an expression to simplify uses of reflection and what have you, and it's just going to execute once, we now have an interpreter available. And so you will still get a delegate, it will still be completely statically typed, but internally it's actually using an interpreter, and it's a pretty fancy piece of technology that you can actually totally check out on the GitHub site. Over here, if you sort of search for expression interpreter, you can actually find all the magic that's happening there. And the last thing I would like to point out is that we are doing a whole lot of work, and that's really, you know, where I want to end. If you take a look on GitHub and you sort of click on those area labels, you will see an awful lot of work is happening in optimizing a whole lot of places of the .NET runtime. Personally, I'm working a lot on system.link.expressions to make the code gen of expression trees much more affordable, much more optimized, all that kind of stuff. But there's a whole lot of other places, you know, where we're doing massive investments and actually a lot of performance tuning and all of that kind of stuff. So you can go to the .NET site, and my recommendation would be once every so often, you know, a few times a week or something, take a look here at the pull requests that are happening and take a look at, you know, what people are doing. And this is an incredible source to learn about things you may not have seen in the .NET framework before, you know. And it's always bite-sized chunks because those pull requests don't tend to be very big. You know, they sometimes fix this, fix that, fix the other thing. So as they flow by, you can sort of see the sausage being made, right, inside the kitchen. And that's quite fascinating, I think. So with that, you know, I hope you enjoyed this talk. We have a whole bunch more, or I have a whole bunch more instances of this talk that you can find on Channel 9 from different conferences, where people likely pick different tapas from the menu. So if you want to sort of, you know, see the story about other things we didn't get to talk about today, please check out the videos online. Also, feel free to reach out to me anytime. And this is actually the last time, you know, I promise, you know, I'm going to change all of these things to remember font sizes. But, you know, feel free to send me an email, talk to me, barty@microsoft.com. Always happy to talk. And if you have any suggestions for things that you found and that you think not that many people know, feel free. You know, I'll add them to the talk. I'll give you credit for, like, pointing it out. And, you know, we can all learn more about how things work. Thank you.